Hello and welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the IRIS Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Finding Amy, A True Story of Murder in Maine by Captain Joseph K. Laughlin and Kate Clark Flora. Copyright 2006 by Joseph K. Laughlin and Kate Clark Flora, published by University Press of New England, Lebanon, New Hampshire. In the last episode on December 8, 2001, an extensive ground search has finally discovered the body of Amy St. Laurent. We resume with Finding Amy on page 126. As the scene was stabilized and decisions were made, the ranking officers on the scene, Lieutenant Brian McDonough from the State Police and Lieutenant Laughlin, had to pass information up their respective food chains so that their superiors would be in the loop. Because the media were already focused on the search and aware that personnel and vehicles had converged on the area off Route 22, news vans had begun to arrive. It was necessary to agree quickly on a uniform story and to convey it to dispatch in Portland and to Stephen McCausland, the state police spokesperson. Then came the complicated issue of staffing the scene. Although Portland and State Police had worked side by side for weeks on the case, the grave site and surrounding crime scene were not in Portland, but in Scarborough, resolving, finally, the question of jurisdiction. Amy St. Laurent was now officially an MSP case. The decision was quickly made, however, to proceed as a team, and the investigators moved on to the question of how the scene would be handled. Whose evidence technicians would do which tasks? Who would videotape the dig, sketch the scene, take the photographs, record and collect the evidence? Whether both the MSP and Portland crime scene vans would be used? The chief medical examiner, Dr. Margaret Greenwald, and her deputy, Dr. Ed David, had to be located, notified, and summoned to the scene. The presence of a body meant that the exhumation could not proceed without Dr. Greenwald. A scene with a body belongs to the medical examiner. Because the body was buried, and the exhumation of a buried body is a detailed and complicated process, Dr. Marcella Sorg, a forensic anthropologist at the University of Maine in Orono, experienced in such excavations, was also contacted. Portland and State Police evidence technicians had to be contacted. The parameters of the crime scene had to be identified and secured. Access to the scene was by the tote road, which was blocked by piles of accumulated debris. Somehow, Todd Coons, one of the Portland detectives, got a road grader that could be used to clear the tote road and allow the state's large crime scene van, a converted mobile home, and Portland's smaller one, access to the site. Before any of that debris could be moved, however, it and the road into the site had to be searched so that no potential evidence would be lost. Since it was obvious that the exhumation process would be going on long after dark, police borrowed a generator and large lights from Scarborough Rescue, which they set up to illuminate the scene deep in the woods, complementing the lights the state police had provided. None of these steps took place without conferences among the ranking officers at the scene, and often consultation with their respective command staffs. But all the investigators proceeded with the smoothness of professionals who were used to the complexity and chaos of crime scenes. Everyone clicked into gear and began doing their jobs. All day long the air had held the promise of snow. As darkness closed in, it brought a damp and biting chill. The detectives could feel the impending snow in the air and knew they were racing the clock. They also knew that one of the basic principles of crime scene investigation is that it cannot be rushed. Crime scene investigation is a detailed and time-consuming process designed to preserve the integrity of the scene and all the information and evidence collected there. The suspicious site was first identified around 2:15 p.m. The code blue was called at 2:40. The medical examiner arrived at the scene at 6:15. During that time, there was a tremendous amount of work to be done before the exhumation itself could begin, following the site protocol. identifying and cordoning off the parameters of the scene, establishing designated paths into and out of the scene to avoid trampling on evidence, documenting the scene in sufficient detail to allow an officer to later recreate it in a detailed written report. Scene documentation involved the taking of detailed notes, not only about the scene itself, but also about the steps taken to capture those details. Mapping, for example, was a very complex and time-consuming process. First, a rough sketch was made. Then, in order to reproduce the scene accurately later, measurements were taken to record distances, angles, fixed items, and movable items. The site was then photographed and videotaped. The site was searched visually and with metal detectors. Every step of the process had to be photographed and videotaped. Evidence discovered was photographed in place with and without identifying numbers, a scale, and an arrow. Along with the usual crime scene requirements, never move, touch, or alter anything until it has been noted, sketched, and photographed, the detectives faced the additional complexities of conducting a forensic dig, the long, slow, careful process of exhuming the victim's body. The fact that it was night and December, and that everyone had already been on the job for nearly 12 hours, was irrelevant. The detectives all had the picture of Amy's smiling face in their minds as they stood around what they now believed was her grave. Soon, perhaps, they would know how she had died. No one wanted to miss a shred of evidence that might help them understand the details of the crime or help them secure a successful conviction of the smooth-talking charmer who had offered Amy a ride home and instead killed her and dumped her into this hole in the ground. Early in the process, Chief Chitwood came through the dark to the scene, congratulated Danny Young, and shook his hand. It felt good to Young to have his efforts recognized. What felt even better was when Detective John Dumas, who had started the day in a piss-poor mood, angry about giving up a Saturday and muttering darkly about finding needles in haystacks, came and shook his hand. For Young, there would be some serious emotional rushes that night. It really hit him hard, he said, when he called his wife Linda from the scene. "You know how I told you I was going to have a day off tomorrow?" he said. "Well, looks like I'm going to be working after all." "You've found her, haven't you?" she said, and only then did he realize that yes, indeed, they had. Chief Chitwood, bouncing with energy, snapping his gum, definitely Clint Eastwood-esque, moves up the tote road to me. When he gets close, I see he's got his jogging suit on. The chief is a workout fanatic. He knows crime scenes and starts off, "Great job, Joe. You guys did a great job." "It was all Danny and Scott, Chief, believe me, and those warden guys are amazing. I still can't believe we found her. Still can't believe." Chitwood moves to Danny, Tom, and others, shaking hands and congratulating them, like they've won a sports event. It's pretty dark now. News teams are choking up the road, I'm told, over the radio. Matt comes up to me, wide-eyed. "Joe!" he grabs my arm. "Joe, you gotta stop the chief from the news. This is the MSP's biggest nightmare." They play it close to the vest, while Chief Chitwood is a lot more open, more willing to speculate. "Oh, yeah, Matt, real easy. Sure, hang on a minute. I'll just go tell him." Media Mike is a publicity hound. He loves the media so much, it's almost like an aphrodisiac. And he's good. The public loves him. I walk up to the chief by the command post. "Chief, can you do me a favor and talk to Matt before you go to the press, so we can agree on issues?" "Sure, Joe, no problem. Where is he?" The chief ambles over to Matt, and they converse. Off to the side, I see white sneakers emerge from the gloom, as if they are walking on their own. Then I see it's Tim Burton. Thank God, I think. Burton has such good logical sense, such a calming effect, and a unique relationship with the chief. He shakes my hand and congratulates me, then looks around curiously. "Where did we get all this equipment, and who's going to pay for it?" "Geez, Tim, not now. We got a potential conflict brewing, and fast. I need you." I ask him to appeal to the chief, before he goes out to the road. Everyone huddles up, and Tim does his thing with alacrity. The last thing I see is Mike Chitwood walking down the dark tote road, jogging suit reflecting the light, heading toward the news like a moth to a flame. As I turn, Matt rolls his eyes because he knows what's coming and strides off into the darkness after the chief. Not my problem, I think, as I turn to the scene. The discovery of what they believed to be Amy St. Lawrence's gravesite in Scarborough, which was under the investigation jurisdiction of the Maine State Police, changed the dynamic of the case. Both police agencies were still working side by side, and both felt it was crucial to the success of the case to keep it that way. At the same time, the jurisdictional shift highlighted what had been an ongoing source of tension, the widely divergent styles of the two agencies with respect to handling the media. It was close to time for the 6 p.m. news. Media vans were lined up on Route 22, and Sergeant Stewart was very concerned about what Chief Chitwood would say to them. Although the investigators all believed they'd found Amy's grave, what they had so far was a scrap of gray sweatshirt and the behavior of the dogs. The medical examiner had not arrived yet. The families had not been notified. MSP and Portland personnel, including Chief Chitwood, discussed the matter, and everyone agreed to say only that a significant discovery had been made, that detectives were now investigating it, and that in a short while, Portland Police and the MSP would issue a joint press release. Chief Chitwood then left the scene and went back out to the road. Sergeant Stewart, following, heard him speak with some reporters to the effect that a buried body had been found. A sweatshirt identified, and detectives believed it to be the body of Amy St. Lawrence. Stewart subsequently spoke with the reporters, explaining that the information was premature until the site had been examined and the families notified, and persuaded the reluctant reporters to hold the story. Stewart then returned to the scene, vigorously protesting the chief's actions, and tried to secure the Portland Police Department's cooperation in keeping a lid on public statements. While Stewart was back at the scene, trying to control what would be said to the media, the chief gave another interview that did make it onto the air, infuriating the state police and the stations that had cooperated in holding the story. Route 22 was ablaze with the flashing lights of emergency vehicles. Scarborough police and state police were out there, preventing the media from having access to the site. Route 22 had been closed. Detectives and evidence technicians were in high gear, searching the tote road and the area around the grave site. Now that the process was underway, it was time for Lieutenant Laughlin and Danny Young to make the painful phone calls to Amy's mother and father, informing them of the discovery. Yeah, okay, Dan. Let me call Diane and you call Dennis. I once again stomp my feet in the cold dirt. It's incredible, amazing that we found her, but I hate this part. I start my journey out to the road, trying to tell myself, it's just another note, we do it all the time. But it's not. How the hell do I say this one? Your daughter's buried? We found Amy? How? Your daughter is in the woods? Hey, Diane, just wanted to let you know we're digging up your daughter. If I didn't know her so well, couldn't see her face so clearly, this would be easier. She's got the saddest eyes I've ever seen, and I've seen enough. Out of the dark, a small cat appears and rubs up against me. I stop and scratch, and am able to pick him up. What are you doing out here, bootleg? I say bootleg because of his black front paw, like he's wearing a little boot. I put him down and tell him to go home, but he insists on following me. I think of Amy, of how she loved cats. Perhaps she's sending an emissary to say, it's going to be okay. Ahead I can see the lights at the street, cars, noise, the Salvation Army truck. There's that kitty again, rubbing hard against my legs. Amy, is that you, helping me, comforting me? I get to my car, parked on the shoulder, away from the bustle of people. I want to get inside and start the heat, but I pause and look at the gray Taurus, hesitating. A voice in my head asks, "Do you find it hard to do your duty?" A movie quote that keeps coming back to me. I'm inside, engine on, police radio spitting out info. Back in the city, it's busy. Gratefully, I suck in the heat. Delaying. Turn off the car radio. Bach, mixed with police radio. I shut the police radio off, too, and stare at my cell phone on its mount. Hey, I can talk hands-free. Delaying as I pull out my notebook to look up a number I know by heart. I capture my own interest as I flip through my beat-up pocket notebook, flipping through a plethora of stories, destroyed lives, most of which I can no longer remember, escaping into other scenes. I turn page after page. Some I remember, some I see, some I smell. Some are just names and gross information. The pages are torn, white, stained, yellowed. Just people. Just life to us. Come on, you know the number. Just call, Joe. Call. The heat has finally seeped to my core. I see a hand reflected in my driver's side mirror. A knock jolts me. The electronic window hums down. Hey, Lieutenant, there's a guy from Channel 13 News, wants to talk, etc. Yeah, yeah, hang on. My leather jacket's creaking with noise. Why did I wear this? I turn down the heat, mentally creating a silence in which to speak, shutting out the world, the city, everything but the dark space in my car. I press the numbers, beep, 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 and the noise is almost deafening. I already see her eyes asking, why? Third ring. Hello? I know it's her. Diane? Yes? It's Joe. Yes? We found her. We found Amy, Diane. We found her. Silence. Silence. A strange, muted sound of pain. Then she says, where? I tell where we are and how she must remain quiet for now. How? She asks. Diane, she was buried in the woods. I'm grasping now, hoping to say the right thing, waiting for her reactions. Diane, she was buried. But Diane, we found her. She's home. I repeat it. She's home. Trying to avoid the barrage of feeling and questions she must have. A muted, thank you. Then, that bastard, that rotten bastard. I can see Diane's face through her voice. The pain, anger, her tired, beautiful eyes, hopeless, but thankful. Diane, we will get him. We will. But you must remain vigilant. Prepare for the news. It's going to be all over the media. They will be calling, so careful in what you say. We talk about the next journey and all the work to do. I tell her about the kitty and how I felt Amy's spirit and comfort. I say I will call in the morning and update her. Then, because I want to be sure she isn't alone, I ask, is Lucille with you? Julie? God bless you, Diane. Stay strong. I hang up. Take a minute before I move on to the other calls I have to make. Stay strong. Diane is so strong. She's amazing. But I have just shattered those last faint hopes that Amy might be found alive. As they removed the carefully cut sod that had been reassembled on top of the grave to mask the signs of digging, Danny Young couldn't help remembering how Gorman had told his friends that the police were never going to find the body. Gorman had tried hard to make sure that this was true, but he hadn't counted on Lieutenant Dorian and the warden service. To ensure that evidence from the body or clothing, including small hairs or fibers, wasn't lost, all the dirt was carefully removed with small trowels, whisk brooms, and soft brushes. It was carried in plastic buckets to detectives who sifted it through two screens. The work was physically hard because of the cold and the weight of the soil and the time and care it took to sift every inch. All the excavation was done by Doctors Greenwald, David, and Sorg, on their hands and knees, peeling the soils away one slow layer at a time. Huge lights illuminated the scene with stark white light, creating a surreal patch of activity in the pitch-black woods. There was noise, but it was muted noise, everyone subdued by the circumstances. Portland evidence technician Chris Stearns and MSP detective Angela Blodgett took photographs. Sergeant Joyce consulted with Portland and MSP evidence technicians. In the background, the generators hummed. Metal detectors beeped as they were run over the ground. The site began to be dotted with rulers and crime scene tape and little tented markers with numbers on them, marking places where evidence had been found. On the tote road, a single sock was found, and then a hair scrunchie. As the excavation progressed, the investigators discovered that much of Amy's body was covered by an old white foundation form used for pouring cement, which measured approximately 14 by 48 inches, one of many that were scattered throughout the woods at the end of the tote road. The form was carefully exposed, lifted off, and collected as evidence. Each hair or other object from the screening was carefully logged, bagged, and tagged. Dozens of pieces of potential evidence were collected from the soil, the body, and the area surrounding the grave. Hours passed. The crime scene workers could feel that the snow was close. Everyone was bundled against the cold, breath steaming in the icy air, fingers and toes going numb as the chill worked its way through their bones. Except for brief trips to the heated vans to thaw their fingers, they worked steadily in the circle of light, toiling with warring senses of overwhelming triumph and profound sadness. We found Amy. For each of those who had been deeply involved in the investigation, there were two different heads reacting to the scene. The emotional head grasped the sadness of the moment and the tragedy of how two lives had intersected so briefly, and things were changed forever. No one had ever abandoned the faint hope that their suspicions of foul play were wrong and one day Amy would turn up. Now they knew that wouldn't happen. At the same time, the professional investigator's head was excited. Now they could leap to the next plateau and get this guy. Down in Troy, Alabama, Gorman was getting phone calls from his mother telling him police were digging in the woods behind her house and her road was blocked. Something big was going on, and it was taking a long time. As the cement form was lifted off and the digging went deeper, maggots were spotted, and the smells of dirt and pungent pine needles were joined by the unmistakable scent of decomposition. Gradually, Amy's head and the outline of her body began to emerge from the reddish-brown soil. Despite the dirt, the Pratt & Whitney logo on her sweatshirt was still clear and bright, a disquieting image when the woman who wore it was so thickly crusted with earth she looked like a mummy. Dr. Sorg noted that the soils in which the body was found were dry and sandy, the top of the body 23 inches below surface. Spade marks were found with an imprint 9 by 9 and curved. Investigators, eager for information about the cause of death, observed seepage from what appeared to be a wound to the head, but little could be known for certain until Dr. Greenwald had conducted her autopsy. A fairly wide excavated area was circumscribed around the body, with Amy's remains on a pedestal, created by digging on all sides down to the lowest level of the body. As her hands and feet became visible, they were carefully covered with brown paper bags to protect against the loss of any evidence. Soil and hair from around her head and pubic area was collected and bagged. Samples of maggots and other insects were carefully collected and bagged for study by a forensic entomologist. It's dark now, and I'm in the command post with a few detectives and Lieutenant Brian McDonough, my counterpart on the Maine State Police. The news people are still out there, and Brian is on the phone with Stephen McCausland, the spokesperson for the MSP. I can hear from the receiver, Brian, you tell Chitwood that I am the damn spokesperson for the state. You tell him that. Brian looks at me, and we both roll our eyes at our predicament. Eventually, he hangs up, and I ask, Okay, Brian, would you rather deal with Chief Chitwood or McCausland? Chitwood backs down from no one. Matt pops into the trailer, glasses steamed, and notes that it's a lot easier when only our small group is involved. So true, Matt, and I think, things are about to get more complicated. Outside in the cold, the exhumation is beginning in earnest. I hear the generators churning. Through the windows, I catch slashes of bright lights. One of the detectives calls me on the radio and tells me the father is out on the road and wants to come up. No, I tell him, no. Hold him there. Tell him I'm on the way. I had met Dennis St. Laurent a few times, but did not have a relationship with him like Danny did. I could have sent Danny out, but he was in the center of things, busy working on the dig. I exited the command post van and noticed a leaning white birch lit up like a beacon leading to the path where Amy was. The red plastic tape that led into the trail across the saplings and brown leaves was illuminated in the dark. That's not our tape. Must be the ME's, medical examiners, or the state's. So strange to be doing a joint scene like this. We've got our own tape, equipment, SOPs, and techniques. I could see a blue tarp through the trees and hear voices floating on the air, breath rising up in clouds on a fringe of the darkness. It was spooky, ghoulish. Got to get to Dennis. I walk through the darkness toward the road, light from the sight fading, and stop, snatching a moment's peace between the commotion of the scene and the chaos at the street, wondering how Dennis will be. As I approach the road, I can see the red blinking flashers of several vehicles. When I'm closer, I see one is a Salvation Army truck with coffee and food. I'm thrilled at the prospect of eating something, but first, there's Dennis. He's standing there, shivering, his breath forming clouds. A small man, a quiet man, brown hair starting to gray, thick eyebrows and a salt-and-pepper mustache, absolutely destroyed by all this. We shake hands and talk about Amy for a moment. I don't know what he'll do, so I make some small talk while I assess him. He's calm, and I start the process again, and I tell him that I believe we found her, that she's buried in a shallow grave up the road. I point. He wants to go up, but I can't let him. Let's get a cup of coffee, Dennis. I put a hand on his shoulder, and I tell him we have a lot of work to do, and it's going to take a while, but I believe in my heart that Amy's there. We sip our coffee in silence. It tastes so warm and good, and I'm reminded to be grateful for the simple things, especially in this cold we're standing in. He's shaking with cold. We both are. He breaks his silence with, You guys did a good job. I tell him it's important not to tell anyone about this except his partner, Kathy. The news doesn't know yet, and we don't want to compromise things with the case. The next step will be arresting that Gorman bastard. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition of the Maine Reader. We're reading Finding Amy, A True Story of Murder in Maine by Captain Joseph K. Laughlin and Kate Clark Flora. This is the Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.